Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. I'm the author of Have to Be a Grown-Up, The Sisterhood, and my very first novel, Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls, is coming on the 11th of February 2021. It's available online and from bookshops, and there is a limited number of special signed editions available from Waterstones for Your Book listeners to pre-order. Huge thank you to everyone who has pre-ordered. It is the very best way for you to support the podcast. Next week, we'll be announcing the winner of the Books to Nourish auction, raising money for Fair Share UK. It means so much that so many of you supported the auction and bid to be on the podcast, and we can't wait to record the special episode. For now, keep an eye out for news at bookstonourish.wordpress.com and do visit fairshare.org.uk to find out more about how you can support vulnerable children. We'll include a donation link in the show notes. Today's guest, Mike Bridle at the Word Icon. But he is a writer who has undoubtedly changed the landscape of contemporary British fiction. He's written for the page and the screen. He's a prolific novelist, and we have all been reading him addictedly since his electric 1993 debut, Trainspotting. It's Irvine Welsh. We talked about his brilliant new book, The Seal Club, a trio of novellas by Welsh, Alan Warner and John King, about the Scottish writing scene, and how Irvine might have been responsible in part for the death of Oberon Waugh. Firstly, I was curious about whether in these times we're living in, have your reading habits changed? Are you reading differently or more or less?
Probably more. But I find my concentration isn't as good as it used to be. I think there's a distracting element about just in the ether, basically, that kind of... I've been, you know, the writing's coming a bit slower and the reading's coming a bit slower, but I've been reading more. I mean, I've not had the TV on at all since COVID. And I've just been reading, basically, and listening to music the whole time. So it's been really good that way. I've been reading a lot of books about kind of economics and, all this sort of kind of where are we now, what's happening stuff. And that kind of, then when that gets a bit depressing, I just go back to reading novels, basically.
No, what you mean, it's tricky to get that balance between feeling the need to be informed. And I think when so much is completely beyond our control, we want to delude ourselves into believing we can control it by informing and informing and informing. But I just want to escape. I read the Cazalet Chronicles, and it was just deeply comforting to be in the Second World War. Because
right,
it was
obviously,
you know, tragic and difficult and painful, but also really boring.
This is so boring. I mean, this whole COVID thing, I'm over it now. It's just too boring to talk about, you know? And it's that kind of thing that it's like, it's red or black in the casino. Whatever you do, you lose. COVID, the house wins, COVID wins, basically. And everything you do is going to have crap consequences. So, I mean, all you want is consistency. Just take a pass, stick to it and all that, and we'll get on with it. But, I'm enjoying escaping as well. You know, I've been started on Alan Warner's new novel, which is set in Sussex, and it's just in the 70s. And it's just, not, you know, it's just his descriptions of the countryside and just, you know, what's happening. And, you know, there are just, it's just really beautiful. It takes you right out of all this nonsense. I've just been reading the Michael Faber book, the Crimson and the big Victorian one. What's it called?
The Crimson and the Petal Pipe.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it was just a bit too, it was too big a read at the time. I thought, this is, I'm not, a, but it's perfect for this environment because a lot of the background noise is gone, you know, so you can concentrate. Well, you, I know you, you can't, I mean, I find it hard to concentrate, but you can immerse, you can sit with something over a long period of time.
So what is that book? Is that, is it like a gothic?
The lead character is a prostitute in the Victorian era, and it's kind of just, it's just after the Jack the Ripper era, so it's not like a kind of a sort of kind of murder mystery. It's very it's just very evocative, very rich kind of written novel. I'm about I think it's about 800, 900 pages long. I'm about kind of 100 pages in, really enjoying it.
I do think there's something now especially really reassuring almost about knowing you're in for a long haul, that you're not going to run out of book. As you said, time for those books that before would have just seemed a bit daunting and a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I wanted to read Underworld, Don DeLillo again. I think it'd be a great book for this time. You know, when I finish with Alan Warner and Michael Faber, I'll get back into that. I'll read it again. It's one of the few books I've read more than once. I don't really like kind of going back to books again. I tend not to. The only exception is Ulysses. I've read about five times now because the first time I didn't understand the word of it. And the second time, you know, it's I kind of just started to not see it as a, you know, as a sort of story, but just see it as a bit of travelogue really across Dublin and just kind of trip on the language of it. And I got much more out of it. And every subsequent time I've got more and more out of it. Every kind of decade I've lived, I've almost read that book, you know, so... But generally, I don't. I just, you know, I'll read things that I want to move on to the next thing, and I don't tend to follow writers very much. I tend to kind of be arrested more by the theme of a novel and what it's about. You know, I'm a kind of dust jacket browser, and then I'll pick up something from that from there, take it home.
That is interesting. I want to come back to that, but I'm curious about what drew you to Ulysses that very first time. What point in your life did you think you'll have? Were you aware of it as an ambitious book? Because I feel as though that's something that's synonymous with being a difficult read.
I think I'd read Alistair Gray's Lanark, because when I started to, you know, the whole route for me to get into reading was basically through the novels of Evelyn Waugh, which I inherited from my uncle, who was a fireman, who did an Open University course, and I got all his books basically. So I kind of got into Evelyn Waugh from there on. So I went through all the English literature kind of stuff. I've kind of backtracked into, you know, the classics like Jane Austen, the Brontes, and all that, and then kind of moved forward into the contemporary stuff, like, you know, from Kingsley Amis on to Martin Amis and Ian McEwan and Julian Barnes, and then found all this great Scottish writing on my doorstep that I didn't really know about, you know, like kind of James Kelman and Alistair Gray and Janice Galloway. And through reading Gray's Lanark, I think somebody had compared it to Ulysses because it was a big, ambitious kind of book. You know, it's nothing like it actually, but it made, you know, it piqued my interest, and I picked up Ulysses, and it was very, very difficult for me to follow it. Basically, it just didn't have any kind of traditional story structure in that sense. But there was something about it that I quite enjoyed, you know. And I thought, I'll maybe go back to this when I'm a bit more, when I'm a little bit less kind of set in my ways, really, because I saw very much, you know, I wasn't really into experimental fiction as such. It was like, it was very much, to me, it was like I just wanted a story with a beginning, middle, and end. And then, you know, basically, you know, through Bowie, I'd almost kind of wanted to get into the beat writers like kind of Burroughs and Ginsberg, Kerouac and all that. And so I did all that. I got into American fiction. And through there, I kind of got, you know, I got into the whole idea that a novel can be anything you want it to be, really. There's not really any rules, but if you break the conventional rules of storytelling, you've got to have a good reason to do it. You know, it's got to be something. And it can only be really a bit, I mean, if one person writes The Naked Lunch or like Burroughs, you know, stuff like, you know, and is really exhilarating, but everybody doing it would just be a mess. You know, there'd be no sort of, there'd be nothing to kick against, there'd be no novelty of it. But it really made me, kind of reading these kind of books made me much more open to the idea that it doesn't necessarily need to be a linear plot line. And, you know, and it was quite influential to me as a writer as well to start to think in that way, that something can be thematic, it can be character driven, it can be atmospheric. It doesn't necessarily need to be plotted in that sense, you know. So I suppose that, you know, Ulysses has given me something different in every sort of, every time I've picked it up in every decade, because I suppose I've been different. I've been
And I guess the more you change as a writer and reader, and everything you read is probably giving you a different lens through which to experience Ulysses again, and something to get out of it.
It does, you know, it's great because it does, one of the things that reading the book kind of is made overt in my own thinking process is that you're never finished at all. You know, you're never finished as a writer or reader. You're never complete, and you're never complete as a kind of learning machine. Mm. You know, that's really what we are. I mean, we're kind of learning machines, and you're striving to, you know, you get something more out of it in every phase. In every phase you're in, basically.
Something I felt very strongly when I read your novels for the first time was the permission to pay attention to this like array of stories. And I think sometimes the literature that we are given to read misleads us and makes us think a life has to be very grand to be worth writing about, and there are certain details that are worthy of observation and others aren't. And I love Evelyn Moore very much, and I wanted to go back and talk about him as well, but even the sort of, you know, in terms of class, in terms of the love stories and the sort of, you know, the patterns and the drama of it, and the details that are worthy of attention, and in the hands of the right writer, you know, absolutely anything is.
You know, it's a thing about anything, about any kind of fiction, any kind of genre fiction. It's like music, you know, the very best in that genre is always going to be good, you know. And it's like, it might not be your personal thing, it might not be kind of something that you really instinctively vibe on, but there's no denying that it's you know, I could name a dozen writers who write in a certain way and who write from a certain kind of genre and perspective. And it's not the kind of thing that I really vibe greatly on, but I do admire it. I do admire the skill and and what they bring to the whole thing. And I do get a lot out of it. Conversely, one of the things as a writer, what I love to sort of and it happens quite a lot, and it's quite liberating when you pick up a book that everybody is raving about and think it's, you know, and a lot of people think is great, and you read it and you think to yourself, this is actually pretty crap. It's not that good, you know. It's a sort of there's a kind of whole there's all sorts of different reasons why, you know, it might be a book that's just hit some kind of zeitgeist and comes of age, and then you think, well, it's not really good. This character isn't convincing. This storyline isn't convincing. This is, you know. And that's very liberating as a writer, because you always think, I can do better than that. You know, most of the good books are just intimidating because you think to yourself, fuck, I'll never be able to write like that. So it's great when you get one that is really sort of given all these accolades, but isn't that good.
I mean, I have a terrible compulsion, which speaks to nothing but my own insecurity, where I've sort of frantically got to Google and like, there must be someone who agrees with me. There must be someone else who hates it as well. But then I've been talking about this book on the podcast a lot. I think it's out in the US, and I think it comes out in the UK in January, Luster by Raven Leilani. It's her debut, and I think she just won the Kirkus Prize, and it has been hugely hyped, but I believe deservedly so. And my reaction upon reading that was very much, I just want to give up. I never want to write a sentence again. I'm very depressed by its brilliance.
Right, yeah. I mean, it is. I think it's like kind of, sometimes great writing can be demotivating, you know, but and bad writing, particularly, you know, sort of kind of well-praised bad writing can be really kind of, yes, you know, this is great, I can do better than this.
I mean, I really want to ask you about those two, if there are any brilliant books that you have felt momentarily demotivated by, and also what are the very hype books? Everyone likes this.
It's kind of, it's fleeting. I mean, it's like, one of the books that, when people ask me what book you think you've would you like to have written that you haven't written? Always say the Da Vinci Code, because I wouldn't have to bother about writing anything else. And, you know, I'm not even think about it. You know? But it's not that great a book. You know, it's not a particularly brilliant book.
No,
but,
it's a retirement book, though. Yeah. I mean, do you think if you had written the Da Vinci Code, say, you would still be writing anyway, because it's what you do and what you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I can't stop. I've got, you know, I've always got loads of books and stories on the go, sometimes all at once, so just type away until one project. Could even be a screenplay. It's usually a book, but sometimes a screenplay or a teleplay, or a stage play, and I'll just let one of them kind of hit a critical mass. You know, if it's a novel, it's usually, but it's usually over, when you get over 20,000 words, you usually know that it's going to be a book, basically. So I'll just go with it when it gets to that level. So it's usually about a big load of unfinished ones that are there, you know. And sometimes they end up getting cannibalized and put into something else, and, you know, I'm always doing something, and I'm always on, if I'm on, I don't drive, so I'm always on public transport. I'm always sitting in the corner of a train or a tube with a laptop, kind of tapping in and getting descriptions of people from the tube and all this kind of stuff.
It's a rich source, although I guess it's that's been harder now.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it's really good. I mean, you can sit on the Circle Line now and there's hardly anybody on it, you know, so you just sit in the Circle Line and go around, and the only people that are actually take the train now are essential workers and kind of and strange people like myself, you know. So you're looking at all these other kind of weird people, so, you know, and you're getting descriptions of them and typing away, and then you can, you know, you can find the thing about London now is that a lot of the coffee shops have kind of shut down and all that, so you can't really, you can't just ensconce in a corner now and just type away all day until the proprietor gets sick of you. But could sit in the park and type, you know, but now it's like the weather's getting to the point where you have to stay indoors. So I'm getting more, I mean, I'm between Edinburgh and London all the time now. I'm back at Edinburgh right now. So I've got, my place here is all sort of, you know, I can just go to my place in London and go to my place at Edinburgh. And it's like, from King's Cross to Waverley, like 2 minutes walk to King's Cross, 2 minutes walk to Waverley. And, you know, 4.5 hours later, you're in the other place. So that's kind of, I've got a nice system worked out.
You mentioned before about finding all these sort of really great Scottish writers when you were first sort of falling in love with books and on that journey. Are there any emerging Scottish writers that you're really excited about?
They don't really emerge, do they? They just go bang the first book, and it's either massively successful, or usually it's not, and you never hear from them again. And sometimes the ones you never hear from again are brilliant, and it's such a sad thing. You know, they don't really get their careers sort of developed like we did back in the 90s. The kind of publishers, you know, I was talking to this, you know, Alan Warner and John King and I doing the Seal Club. We were talking about this, that how we were kind of looked after in a way by Random House and Cape, and, you know, we were sort of brought through, you know, and it wasn't really because we were in this little, we were all published by Cape, and it was like this little enclave within Random House, and it didn't really matter if it wasn't turning around huge profits. It was almost like we'd be subsidized, you know. Well, Cape is on it. And I was lucky. I kind of used to make quite a bit, well, still do make quite a bit of money from books, but it's like generally Cape authors didn't, you know, they're like poets. They were sort of one or two of them would do okay, and the rest of them were subsidized by the big kind of crime novel of the day or whatever, you know. So it was quite nice. It was a bit like when I was doing music and I was signed to Creation Records, the dance imprint Eruption, and we were doing all this dance stuff, and Noel Gallagher came in and said, like, am I subsidizing these bastards now, you know? So it was true, you know, it was kind of it was a bit like that with Cape. But they would, you know, but they would look after writers back then, and I think now it's much more profit centred. Everyone is a sort of has to turn in a kind of a certain kind of profit, and there's a marketing strategy for every book and a demographic. It's a bit like film, writing for film, and, you know, you're writing to marketing holes. So there's not a lot of latitude for young writers now. But I mean, there's some great writers, and it's like I kind of feel strange about calling somebody that's 40
emerging
a young writer, but they kind of are as young writers. Yeah. So somebody like, I mean, like Jenny Fagan, I've just read her new novel Locking Booth, and it's absolutely amazing. It's like what I love about it is that first, what I love about it, it's really, really long, and it kind of brings back ambition into the British novel. You know, it's like, so because again, it's like she's not writing into any sort of marketing hole. Anybody will tell you that you can't write a novel now if, you know, like 800 pages. It's just crazy. But she has done, and it's just absolutely amazing and riveting and brilliant. And it's a bit, it's like a kind of, it's a bit like Lanark in a lot of ways, Alistair Gray's book, but it's very much a sort of whole feminist kind of working class reclaiming of Edinburgh as a city. And it's, you know, you have walk on cameos from William Burroughs and all this kind of stuff. It's just a nutty book, you know, and all these in Chinese triads, and it's crazy, crazy book, but absolutely brilliant and fabulously executed. I think it's going to make a huge splash when it comes out next year.
I'll look out for that. That sounds really, really dazzling. Skipping back to Evelyn Moore, I think that Decline and Fall is one of the funniest books ever and a real sort of almost like a masterclass in how to write a joke, because I think his sense of kind of rhythm is so good.
Well, that's what I got as well from him. The characters were incredibly vivid. And the thing that I got, I mean, I started off with the Guy Crouchback trilogy, you know, the Men-at-Arms war trilogy. And what I really got from that was, I mean, it's totally outside of my social milieu that I'm writing about, but the universal thing that I picked up on it, and I think kind of inspired me very much in my own writing, was the sort of, was a camaraderie, but the secret schadenfreude and competition between men, basically. You know, and it really has that kind of down to a, you know, down to a sort of T. This kind of sort of friendship, but kind of real rivalry, and almost kind of tipping over into sort of hatred and sort of love. And it's a bizarre kind of concoction. And he really nails it, I think, more so than any other novelist. And he does it in a very funny way as well. Mm. He's a great humorist writer. And it's funny, it's like, I remember being on a flight with Oberon Waugh to Sydney Writers Festival. And we're on a long-haul flight, we're having a drink and chat and all that. And, you know, Oberon Waugh was kind of, you know, he was kind of a very kind of snobbish kind of sort of upper-class guy. And I thought, should I tell him how much his father's influenced me? No kind of relatively underachieving son wants to hear about, particularly a posh kid, wants to hear about how great his father was. Like, you know. So I said, what I'll do is I'll wait, because it's really going to offend him that I was massively influenced by his father, you know. So wait till he gets a bit obnoxious and posh, and then I'll hit him with it. And I did, then he just went into this kind of traumatized kind of sort of slump, and then pretends to be asleep after that, and kind of died shortly after that, actually. So it must have, it must have been quite traumatic for him. But yeah, no, I'm joking. He was a nice guy with quite a good laugh, and yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was something that I got into purely by accident. But it's that thing as well, you know, you have to be able to draw from everywhere. You can't let any kind of sort of preconceived ideas about what is, you know, what constitutes kind of good writing or good literature kind of get in your way. You have to sort of, if you're a proper reader, you'll take joy in something from anywhere, wherever it comes from.
What is the book that surprised you the most, where you took a lot from it without expecting to?
It's funny because some books are like kind of little time bombs. You know, you don't think they've had much influence on you when you've read them, and then you keep thinking about them again. You know, so it's like, and they keep kind of coming back on you. So influence is very strange. I mean, you know, it's like you can be you can whiz through a book and it's a kind of virtuoso performance. You think this is great and you feel great about it, and you realize that you've just been entertained. You've not really had any deeper kind of you know, for want of a better term, kind of artistic or cathartic kind of experience from it. And something that you think was a bit dull and kind of maybe a bit ponderous and worthy, if you stick with it, the rewards, you know, they can bleed through you for such a while to come. I think one of the, I'm trying to think of the books that have, this is the thing, I just read so much that I actually forget titles and authors just kind of fly out my head. It's kind of words and phrases and paragraphs that stick in my mind. I think maybe that's the writer in me, you know, that you're always looking for something that you can use or that can influence you or that you can steal or borrow or adapt or amend. So I tend to think of it more in that way.
Especially, you know, what you were saying about not really following particular writers, but looking for ideas that interest you and things that draw you to them. I think that's a really important thing to remember. And what you were saying about how years ago, a publishing house, not always, but did perhaps have more of a tendency to sort of look after and really like develop and bring out their writers. And I think there are fewer writers. And now it's like, oh, we're going to publish 600 new writers a week. And it's just shit we're throwing at the wall. And we're going to see what sticks and what doesn't. And I think there's so much pressure now for writers to kind of to be a brand.
You give so much of your energy and time to, you know, and basically as a promotional tool, you know, it's like, but I think this is the thing is, it's like writers, kind of young writers now, they don't really get a space just to be writers. You know, they have to be authors instantly, you know, so they have to be responsible for the promotion and the, you know, of their work and the promotion of themselves and the promotion of this thing that they're doing. And they have to really be on that. They have to be on it through Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. That's not a great thing because you're almost, you know, being a writer and being an author are just so different thing. You know, they're so different. And it's like you spend a lot of time. The more successful you become, the more you become an author. And you kind of almost think, wouldn't it be great if nobody kind of read my books anymore, so I could just write them in peace and get on with it. And that, you know, and that's a stupid way to look at life as well, because you've got the whole point of it is engaging with kind of people in the world and all that stuff. But there's something about the responsibility that comes with that to go out and promote that's kind of very, very wearying and very, and it feels like every time I do a book tour now, and I used to really enjoy them, and now there's a tremendous sense of déjà vu. You know, I'm kind of I'm responding to the same questions and the themes have been explored. You know, the I've explored all these themes, and I'm kind of not, my head's not really in that book anymore. You know, what was it? I think it was Ian McEwan who said that you become a sort of employee of a former self when you do that thing, that, you know, the promotion thing. And I think it's true. You don't really you're not invested in it. And the embarrassing thing is that the journalists or the that are talking to you, or the members of the public, if you're doing a talk in a bookstore or a theatre or something, they'll have a much better idea of the book than you, because it's gone from your head and there's nothing, you know, it's like you don't really know, you know. So and it's for somebody like me who tends to sort of focus more on the subconscious in writing, I don't really know how I've kind of come to all these things that I've written about. So you find yourself stunned by your ignorance of your own work. You know, you're sitting there and people are saying, you know, they're saying this is, and they've internalized it and they've thought through it. And they probably know a lot better than you about, you know, as readers do, I think. The readers do know more about the work than authors in some ways, because they're seeing it from a, you know, I think you're blinded by your myopic view of trying to construct something. Yeah,
it's true. I think that if you're a really focused reader, you never stop being a student. And I'm sure that, you know, there are lots and lots of readers who love your work, and they want to kind of, they see patterns and see subtexts and things. And, you know, and also you don't, the, I think you're right. It's like, you
they
correct
tell you
me
what
because
it's about,
this,
you know,
is,
it's
your
world,
not mine. But it's like music, and you're creating like 16 different tracks at once in your head, and you can't know what they all are consciously. And it's just this, you know, that's the
you need people to tell you. Thing. You do. You need people to tell you what it's about, because you don't. You won't really know otherwise.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
We'll be back to Irvine soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, Perfect Happiness by Penelope Lively. Frances is struggling to make sense of the sudden death of her husband Stephen, and Stephen's celebrity status makes her life as a widow much more complicated. Her best friend, Stephen's glamorous, ambitious sister, wants to guide Frances through her grief while dealing with her own, but there are, of course, complicated family secrets to unpick. This is a quiet book that roars. Lively is such a spare and elegant writer. There's a gentleness and delicacy to her prose that really belies the intensity of emotion explored. She absolutely wins you. One of the most emotionally intelligent and perceptive books I have ever read. Beautiful and kind and moving. Perfect Happiness is published by Penguin and out now. Now, back to Irvine.
Do you know that writer, J.T. Leroy, The Hard to Sleep with Above All Things, which I think is short stories, but that J.T. Leroy was really a woman named Laura Albert, and they made a film, a documentary called Author, and it's about how she constructed this persona, and that J.T. Leroy is a sort of, you know, very, very damaged young boy. He didn't really exist. And I think about that film and that book all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know that story. I mean, it sounds a bit like the James Frail story about when he wrote something he wrote this supposed biography, and he fictionalized it to the point that, but it kind of fell between biography and fiction, and he probably, it seemed like he didn't realize that he was a fiction writer, and he kind of, he strayed into fictional territory, and then he wrote he wrote a follow-up book to it, which was pure fiction, and was brilliant because it was like he was just freed from the shackles of having to sort of to authenticate kind of things and all that. But again, that's bringing to the sort of the idea that how do you write in other voices? Can you write in other voices? Should you? You can go from the extreme of do you have to be a murderer to write about killing someone? That's most of the crime fiction is writers are kind of in prison if you follow that. So it's a strange thing. You get into all that kind of cultural appropriation, and you get into I always cringe when I hear like authenticity used as a term in fiction, because fiction is about, it's about fabrication. It's not about authenticity. It's like you can try and make the experience of the world as authentic as you like, but you basically are creating a world. It's not you're not taking people into a world that exists. You're creating a world that exists in your head, because it's all your interpretation of that world. It's not you're not taking a photostat of it.
I guess there are two tensions at play, and one is it needs to, I think, feel authentic and be convincing. And that's the writer's job, is to make something that is sort of, even if it's, space aliens, like believable, a consistent universe, I guess. But the other thing is, why would we bother reading fiction if we want authenticity? Because it's inauthentic in its nature.
It's about creating a convincing world that, you know, that could exist in the that can exist in the reader's mind, and it, you know, and it has a set of rules that things that are reasonable happen. You know, it's like a lot of the fiction, you know, if you read a lot of crime fiction, I've been reading loads of crime fiction because we've got this it's kind of pseudo crime series that's been greenlit for BritBox that we're working on, but it's like you get kind of high end stuff, you know, all the Scandinavian stuff that's really good and really psychologically kind of powerful, and then you get the lower end stuff, which is the kind of pseudo James Bond stuff that the guys that, you know, has a first class degree in Oriental languages in Cambridge, but is somehow a kung fu expert and a car guy on the streets and all that kind of stuff, which is just nonsense, you know. But it's very much that kind of white supremacist kind of male upper class sort of model of godlike omnipotence that is imbued in that fiction. So when you read back all these crazy kind of cultural constructs, you know, I was reading that Dashiell Hammett kind of early sort of kind of noirish kind of pre-Chandler kind of fiction, and it's like it's absolutely amazing that the number of every single page is pouring a drink. You know, he goes, like, I poured a drink, and she poured me a drink, and I poured it. Let's get a cocktail, and all. Let's grab a cocktail. You know, they're doing this every single. You know, it's like the guy must be absolutely fucking rat arse by the end of the first chapter. Like, you know, how can you actually function?
I remember when I was a teenager reading Tender as the Night, very different. I mean, there's a murder in it, a big spoiler. Yeah. But being thrilled by the glamour of it and the booziness of it. And that's a book that I try to read every year, and I find something different in it every time I go back to it. And, you know, even though, and I'm like, oh, he makes it very explicit that Dick has a drinking problem. Dick is a chronic alcoholic. Like, oh, but the parties.
That's to me what that book is about. It's about his wife's descent into mental illness and his descent into alcoholism. You know, it's that kind of folly a due thing. You know, him reacting in this way. You know, it's a cultural thing with him drinking, but him reacting in that way to her, kind of basically losing her mind. You know, and it's such a dark and sad book. It's beautifully written, so you can't, you know, you've another one I pick up from time to time. Yeah.
If it touches a little bit on what you were saying about war, that it's kind of about, you know, as a lady, I'm not sure, I don't want to point any fingers or make any statements, but about a very sort of maybe a male anxiety about mediocrity and insecurity, and this idea that Dick could be brilliant, and it's just that wasted potential, and he could blame Nicole and blame the situation, but ultimately it's just a sort of a sad evaporation of something.
I think so. I mean, I think what you see and what I've seen, you know, the older I've got, particularly amongst a lot of guys who come from quite privileged backgrounds, are really bright and very charming, but and have inherited money, but they can't really do anything. For some reason, they just, you know, everything they've needed, they've kind of had in a way, but they've not really had affection growing up. They've been shipped off to these kind of schools, institutions, and it's like they should be able to do all these things, but they can't somehow do them. They have all this, you know, and they sink into this alcoholic oblivion. It's almost like it's a really, I thought it was a kind of, when I first read it, it was a strange story, and then it became immersed in these kind of bigger kind of sort of bourgeois social milieus and all that, and you just see how widespread it is. You know, you see that that the class system in Britain and the patriarchy in Britain has been so devastating to the male bourgeoisie as well. You know, it's something that's not kind of often sort of explained. It's been in the, it turns out devastating from the rest of it, for the rest of us, because you have people now in government who are just from that, you know, they're just damaged guys who've got daddy complexes, who were never given that kind of sort of love, and they were just shipped off, and they were sort of they're acting out all this, so, you know, they're acting out, you know, the they've been promoted way beyond their level of competence. Yeah. They're acting up out now, you know.
So, are there any books that give you hope or you think inspire good social change?
I like ones that are kind of ambiguous. I don't like ones that are saying everything's going to be rosy, everything's going to be brilliant, or everything's going to be horrible. I think the encouragement is in the fact that there's still a little kind of, even though it seems to be shrinking, there's still a little arena of choice that we can make, you know, that we can, you know, and an idea that what we, you know, that there are still some options open. One of the best books, I was talking about Jenny Fagan earlier in our Luckin book, one of the best books about climate change I read was her second book, The Sunlight Pilgrims. It's basically about this family who, the snow is coming in and it's getting colder and colder and colder. The temperatures are dropping and they reckon there's a big sort of a big freeze coming in. So they take this caravan to the north of Scotland and they live in this caravan and the snow's piling up and it's like eventually they get, you know, fewer and fewer supplies and they'll cut off more from the rest of the world. And it's like the way that it ends is quite amazing because you're waiting for the weather to thaw, and it might happen in a week's time or a few days' time, or it might never happen at all. You don't know, and they're all sitting there. And I think this is, you know, it's like you have a sense of how the world could actually end. You know, it's not going to end with mass kind of sort of riots and shootings on the streets or people being incinerated. It's people sitting in the house wondering whether if they're ever going to be able to get out, basically.
Oh my God, you're so right. Fucking hell.
But yeah, you see it now with the COVID thing, you know.
Yeah.
To me, it's like a, you know, it's like a family Christmas. It's like, kind of, are we ever going to get out of this madness? Yeah. But the way that this is described is absolutely brilliant because you don't really know. You don't know if it's just a more severe winter or if it's the end of the world.
God, that sounds chilling in every sense. It's the hope that kills you.
Yeah. Well, I'm a hip supporter, so that's the way we know about that.
I wanted to ask you about music books and if there are any biographies you love.
Well, I mean, the one I read that's, was published by Lee Braxton, who's set up his White Rabbit Press just to do that kind of thing, is Mark Lanegan's biography from the, you know, it's like then Mark Lanegan from the Screaming Trees biography. And the thing about that is it's one of the bleakest books you'll ever read because he's become one of these guys who come from a backwater town, kind of sort of history of abuse and, you know, alcoholic kind of sort of background, and he goes and he becomes a big rock and roll star. Basically, he becomes successful kind of rock and roller, and that's, you know, you think that it's not one of these archetypal, my life was saved by rock and roll. Mm. Rock and roll just gave me access to more tools to destroy myself. So yeah. I was getting more drugs, more heroin, more abuse, more. And he kind of becomes, you know, he's got this parallel kind of rock and roll career to being this bum on the street in Seattle. And it's like, it's absolutely amazing that the level of self-hatred and denigration and sort of but sheer brutal honesty that comes from the book. It's, you know, it's like, and it's like, it's that thing you think, you're rooting from every chapter. You're saying like, you have to get over feeling bad about yourself now. Please, please, please have this, you know, you've hit rock bottom now. Just come up and have some, give us some redemption. And then the next chapter's even worse. He falls even further. You can't think, and at the end, he leaves the end quite sort of ambiguous. There's no big declaration that I was saved by rock and roll or this is what I do and all that, but he seems to come to some kind of inner peace with himself. But it's, but, you know, it's incredibly hard won, massively brave and massively kind of strangely uplifting book, but beautifully written and really honest, and it was much more than a rock and roll biography.
I don't know if you will have read this book. I'd be a little surprised if you have, but maybe not. Do you know that memoir, I think it's called How to Murder Your Life by Kat Marnell, who's the American journalist.
No.
But what I loved about it is she was a sort of like a very like traditional, I guess, kind of glossy, like Condé Nast beauty editor. She got hired for this website, XO Jane, that's supposed to be quite disruptive. ended up being the drugs and narcissism columnist at Vice. And she writes really openly, and she sort of owns being a bit of a brat, and her family was sort of wealthy and distant. Again, one of those kids. She was, I think her dad started prescribing her Adderall and lots of it when she was like preteen. And her memoir is about being a drug addict. She famously wrote a sort of public resignation letter to XO Jane saying, "I'm sorry, I'd rather smoke angel dust than come in and go to work." But it's really great because she says, "I'm like, I don't do heroin overmore, but I will take Adderall until the day I die." And she's quite kind of weirdly hopeful, but also very pragmatic about the way she will always have a relationship with drugs.
Oh, that sounds great. I'll check that out then.
I was thinking so about Eve Babbitt. So I don't know if you've come across her at all.
I haven't. No, the thing about the, I've been in America for 10 years, and in the last 10 years, I moved away from fiction. I think a lot of fiction writers do, kind of at my age, basically, because you're drawn to understand the world a bit more, and you're basically too old to go out to nightclubs and sort of all that kind of stuff. So you kind of try to replenish your understanding of the world in a, you know, not so much in an experiential way, but much more in a secondhand kind of way, looking at the sort of the big thematic issues. So I've been immersed in kind of like, you know, like economics and philosophy and sort of and spirituality, religion, just getting into all that kind of stuff to see what I can unravel from it all. And again, you know, COVID has forced me back into the novel, and it's been great because, you know, when your world shrinks, it does, now it's locked in, it shrinks to a couple of streets, basically, you know. I've got the girlfriend up the road, and I've got my best mate around the corner in his little studio, and Tesco's in the other corner, and that's it, basically, now, you know, unless I can jump on, I can get up to Waverley Station and get down to London, and it's the same, very similar closed thing, you know. And I find London in the lockdown is worse than anywhere else because it's usually there's so much going on and you really know the lockdown more, you know. But it's good for reading, you know. So, you know, it's good to kind of you want to escape your confines, and it's in the, you know, it's in the past. It's like, you know, one of the things I think that's killed the novel is a mobile phone. If you read or write a contemporary novel and you don't have a mobile phone in it, you think to yourself, like, it spoils so much, you know, it's potentially spoils so much suspense. And if you're writing about any kind of, you know, going back to authenticity, if you're writing about anything to do with the real world, you know, you have to reference this in some way, and it's so tiresome. And that's why, you know, a historical novel, you know, and by historical now, I mean like almost like 90s upwards, like kind of pre-mobile phone obsession. It's, you know, these are the ones that you enjoy reading. You get into all that thing as a writer. How do I display the topography in the mobile phone? How do I make these conversations seem interesting? We talk about the death of the novel, as people are doing all the time, but put the mobile phone in the dock, like, you know. not in the charging dock in the decommissioning dock.
I have a question for you, but it relies on me knowing how to pronounce a Scandinavian word I'm not completely sure about, so let me see if I can find it. An Icelandic tradition, it is called Jólabókaflóð.
No, if you can't pronounce it, I've not heard of it.
It is an Icelandic tradition where it's about the Christmas giving of books as gifts, and everyone gets a book as a gift, and they just spend that Christmas week or 3 days just sort of hold up reading it. What book would you give as a gift, and what book would you most like to receive that you haven't read yet?
What would I give? I would probably give, could I give one of my own? Is that cheating?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I just keep thinking royalties and sales and all that, like, as most writers do. So I'd probably give, I'll give more, I'd probably give Glue or Marabou Stop Nightmares or Skag Boys.
I mean, would it depend on who you were giving it to, which one you chose?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. But yeah, if it was someone else's book, it would It'd be one I've finished recently, so it would be like maybe Jenny Fagan's Lochinvar.
And what would you hope that you were going to open? I'm going to put it in a weird book, so you think it's a bike or something.
It's going to be one of these big novels. Then, yeah. what would I hope for? Probably quite a sort of... most of the books that I know about I've already read. This is the thing. So it would have to be a kind of it would have to be a surprise book, you know. I really can't think about that, Daisy, because it's like any book that I would really like to receive I've already read, you know. And it's like the ones that I don't know about, and if it really blows me away, it's like that's the thing that I'm looking for. I mean, I think the last book that I got as a present was years and years ago from somebody sent me Ned Bowman's Boxer Beetle novel, and I thought it was terrific. And funny thing was, I met him a few weeks later at this literary festival. I'd never heard of him or the book and all that, and the book was just great. And I was like, and you know, it was embarrassing because he was a lot younger than me, and I was like a kind of fanboy. I thought, this is fucking great novel, it's brilliant, everything. And I was like, so it was. So that's the kind of surprise that you like. You like to be surprised by a novel.
Awesome. I love that mentionitis as well, that, you know, you sort of discover something and then it just keeps coming up.
Yes. Yeah, it's great.
All right. Well, maybe I'll give you that Kat Marnell book for Christmas. I think you'd like
it. Yeah, that would be brilliant. I would love that.
Send it your way. I'm really excited about Seal Club, which I'm reading your story.
Well, the Seal Club is, I suppose, like a trilogy of novellas with me and Alan Warner and John King. We just decided we would do something for these dark COVID days, basically. And, you know, we managed to turn it around very quickly through an independent press it's John's own independent press. So, yeah, no, it was great.
I was wondering how the three of you came together and whether, as part of that, the writing felt sort of more cohesive because you had two other kind of writing partners to answer to.
Yeah, but we're quite different as writers in a lot of ways, but we're all published at Cape at the same time, and we're all kind of close friends, and it just seemed to be the right thing to do, you know. It just seemed to be, you know, I think, because publishing a book is usually quite a solitary experience, and when you do a novella, it's quite nice to be with other people, to have this, you know, this investment in it, to be like a daft little gang. You know, it's like being in a band almost. It's just been a joyful experience. And normally it's like the writing a book is an absolute joy. It's a wonderful thing. And then when you actually come to publishing it, you think, I've got to kind of go out there and talk about it and all that. I don't really know that much about it. But Alan and John are much better at that kind of thing than me. They actually seem as if they've read their book or their story, you know. So it's kind of... I have to learn from them and maybe prepare better, maybe force myself to read the story. But it's like the last thing I want to do when I hand the book in is to look at it again. I never want to see it again.
I always think when I finish anything, I think it's the poster for End of Days, which is not a remarkable film, but it's just that shot of Arnie walking away from an explosion and everything is like behind me just whistling. And that's my life. That's everything I do. Get out.
Well, you know, I got it wasn't his finest hour, because I knew that film was going to bomb, because I got invited to the premiere, you know. And I always think, like, if I'm getting invited to a premiere of a Hollywood blockbuster, because I'm kind of, you know, I'm B to C list and that kind of thing, you know, I would never get invited to like Terminator premiere. Right? The End of Days, suddenly it comes through the post, like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Gabriel Byrne would love to see you at the premiere. I think, oh, fuck, this is going to be
I'm not sure I agree, but that is charmingly self-effacing. Huge thanks to Irvine. The Seal Club is out now. Buckle up for the return of the Begbie family in Irvine's story, The Providers. As you'd expect, it's darkly comic, uncompromising, painful and thrilling to read. And you can see Irvine in his new Sky Art series, Offended, where he explores public outrage and controversy in the arts.
I'm Daisy Buchanan and I have been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at @YBooked. If you've enjoyed this episode, it would make my day if you left us a 5-star review. It helps new listeners find the podcast. Find a list of all the books mentioned by Irvine on acast.com/booked. Finally, I leave you with this from Dorothy Parker. I'd like to have money and I'd like to be a good writer. Those two can come together, and I hope they will, but if that's too adorable, I'd rather have the money. See you next time.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey there! Did you know Ralph's always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Ralph's app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Ralph's today. Ralph's, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.